Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the podcasts that are going on over there. Guys, while you're over there, you can go to the events page because we got one more city event this year coming up in Las Vegas, March 21st. We'll be going through the entire book of Galatians. It's free. The link is in the show notes, or you can go over to the site. You just sign up and show up. That's all you got to do. We just got done with a city event in Houston that was great. If this event is anything like that event, you'll want to be there. So get all the information over there. Also, Germany and Sweden will be there the first 2 weeks of May. I'll put a link in the show notes to those conferences so you can register up. We'll be talking about Christian freedom at both of those events. Chad and I will both be there along with Eric Sorensen and Scott Keith. So we would love to have any of you European listeners come out, hang out. We'd love to meet you. Chad, you have been a busy man now. All your writing and your speaking and you're doing podcasting. And not just this podcast, but you have another podcast that you are one of the contributors on that it just released.
It did, yeah. First 8 episodes went out of the podcast Hidden Streams. So check that out. Where we get your podcast at. It's kind of a unique podcast for in the podcast world, and especially for 1517. So each one is about 15 minutes long. It consists of a reading of a psalm, and then I have about a 4 to 5 minute reflection, kind of meditative reflection upon that psalm, and then that's followed by music that fits with the theme of the psalm. So they're going to be great for just your own devotions, or if you're a pastor, you could share these with members of your congregation, or use them as in family devotion kind of times. And we're pretty excited about it. So eight of them are out so far, and hope you can sign up and enjoy them.
Yeah, you guys should check it out. It is definitely different than anything else we do, and it is. It's pretty calming, you know. It's as someone who I'm just not great at that devotional life, you know. That's not what I do. I get up and I take my kid to school and get to work and all this stuff. And so I've listened to a few of these and it's kind of nice. It's get my coffee and it's just not that long. You know, it's not like this podcast where you have to make a big time commitment. It's about 15 minutes long and yeah, really great. So I will actually put a clip. A little excerpt from one of the episodes at the end of this podcast. So as we wrap up, instead of hearing the typical outro music, you will hear excerpt from the Hidden Streams podcast. So go check that out. It's available everywhere where podcasts are. You know, if you listen to this podcast, you're already okay with hearing Chad's voice, so you can go hear some more of Chad's voice on that thing. All right, well, where are we at in the wonderful book of Judges? We got we left Gideon with 300 guys ready to do some damage.
Yeah, the dog soldiers, right?
The dog soldiers. They don't know how to drink water, but apparently they're gonna do some damage to the enemies of God.
Yeah, they've got a very very odd battle plan, which is where we left them at. Yeah, we're in Judges chapter 7, and we finished up with verse 7 last time. This is where God decides that He's going to greatly reduce the armed force of Gideon. So you get 32,000 guys show up for the battle. I mean, they're ready. They're ready to rock and roll against the Midianites and these other enemy forces. God's like, nope, way too many. So whoever's scared, go home. So 22,000 guys leave, 10,000 left. God's still like, nope, still too many. So this is when we have the whole how do you drink water test. And the guys that drink water like a dog, They get selected. So now we're down to 300. So we're going to find out now, beginning in Judges 7, verse 8, exactly what the battle plan is. And it is probably one of the most ridiculous battle plans that anybody's ever come up with. But that's what God specializes in. He likes to conduct warfare in very foolish sorts of ways. So verse 8 of Judges 7. Says the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands. And Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now, we've seen about two or three times in the story of Gideon that there are breaks in the sequence that you would expect would happen. Now, reading along there, Gideon has 300 guys, gets these provisions, gets the trumpets. And you think the next verse would be kind of the battle plan, right? What are they going to do? But just like we've seen multiple times in this story, there's going to be this kind of long parenthesis, this long break where something happens that kind of slows down the action of the narrative. It's going to take a detour. And the detour in this particular case is actually kind of a reflection of some of the other stuff that we've seen about Gideon, because it has to do with the hesitation and the fear that Gideon has about whether he's actually going to be able to pull this off. So we pick up with verse 9, and it says, that same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I've given it into your hands. But, he adds, God adds, but if you are afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp, and you'll hear what they say. And then afterward, your hands will be strengthened that you may go down against the camp. So God doesn't even wait for Gideon to respond. He says, first of all, go against the camp because I've given it into your hands. But knowing Gideon as he does, God's like, but if you're scared, if you're afraid, then sneak down there with your servant, and whatever you hear, he doesn't tell him what he's going to hear, but he says, whatever you hear, well, that's going to take care of your lack of confidence. That's going to remove your fear. So, well, what is this thing they're going to hear? That's what we're about to find out. He says he went with his servant down to the kind of the extremity, the outpost of the army that was in the camp. So they're a sneak down there under the cover of night. I mean, get as close as they can to where the enemy soldiers are, so that they can listen in on whatever they happen to be listening in on. They really don't know what they're going to hear, but here's what they find out. Verse 12 says that the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the sons of the east, they were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. This lot of guys, huge enemy camp here. And Gideon and his servant, they hear, this is verse 13, they hear this guy, one of the soldiers, who is telling a friend of his about this dream that he had. He says, I had this dream, and here's what the dream was. He says, there was a loaf of barley bread that came tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent, and it struck the tent, this barley bread loaf, it struck the tent so that it fell, and it turned it upside down, and the tent lay flat. Okay, so that's the dream. It's pretty, I mean, if I came to you, Dan, and I was like, man, I had this weird dream last night. Like there was this loaf of bread that just came, like we were camping out, we had our tent set up, and this loaf of bread came tumbling into the camp, and it hit this tent so hard that it flipped it over and it was flat. What do you think that means? You'd probably be like, I don't know, man. It just sounds like you had some bad Mexican food for dinner or something. I don't know. It's a strange dream. But I mean, I won't even tell you some of the dreams I've had. I mean, I have some weird dreams, and I have no idea what they mean most of the time. So I need an interpreter so you can explain this one to me. Well, anyway, here's his buddy happens to be, you know, kind of a dream interpreter, I suppose. Because he's got the answer. Here's what this means, he says. He's his friend. And I love it, the confidence of his friend. He's just like 100% sure. Oh, he's like, yeah. Here's what that means. This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. And that's it.
Yeah, that seems like some wild certainty.
Yeah, there's some wild certainty. I have no idea whatsoever. I tried to figure it out. I can't figure it out. I have no idea what their association is between Gideon and a loaf of barley bread. There's nothing in the Hebrew. I mean, it's just, I don't know why what the association between Gideon and the loaf of barley bread would be. But that guy did. He knew.
Yeah, it does seem that back in the day, they took dreams a lot more seriously than we do now.
Yeah, I mean, They do. I was thinking about this too, that, you know, this is actually pretty typical of the biblical story, that whenever, of course, God gave this dream to this enemy soldier, I mean, and the interpretation, but you know, anytime, almost anytime, I think there's one exception, but most of the time when God wants to relay something to a non-Israelite, he doesn't use like an oracle or an angel appearing to him or just some divine voice speaking to him. Almost exclusively, it's in terms of dream.
Yeah.
You know, he did this with, way back, the second time that Abraham lied about Sarah being his sister, he appeared in a dream to Abimelech. He appeared in a dream to Laban. Of course, the most famous would be his dreams, the dreams that God gave to Pharaoh, which Joseph interpreted. I think the only exception is our friend, oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank here.
Balaam,
yeah, thanks. I think the only exception is Balaam. Balaam's kind of an exception in himself, though. I mean, he's kind of a weird, he's like a prophet, but not an Israelite prophet. And he actually, I mean, of all things, he prophesies the birth of the star of Jacob. I mean, there's some kind of weird things going on there with Balaam, but I think he's the one exception as far as like non-Israelites that God communicates to. Almost every time it's in terms of a dream, which, of course, is exactly what happened here, too.
Yeah, and it seems, I mean, you don't know anything about these dreams. It's not as though, like, every time someone dreams, they go into a panic. I mean, people dream all the time. So you have to assume, I mean, like, you have to assume that when Pharaoh has a dream or Joseph has a dream or a cupbearer and a baker have a dream, these must be a little bit different than the dreams that I have. I mean, because you see guys up in a panic, you know.
Yeah.
You see that, yeah. Nebuchadnezzar, you know, like these dreams must be unbelievably vivid or something, where they're like, okay, dude, I had a dream, and I'm not talking about like just any old dream. You know? So I would almost venture to say that I've not had a dream that is like those dreams, because I don't wake up wondering what does it mean.
Right.
You know, but yeah. I suppose there is a certain kind of dream that you could have where you might.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, I guess in my own experience, the closest I've ever come, I'm not saying this was revelatory, but just as far as like a dramatic dream, are those where my heart is racing so fast and I'm so nervous or distraught about what's happening in the dream that I actually wake up. And my heart feels like it's going to pound out of my chest. You know, that's happened extremely rarely in my own case. But I assume it's something like that. I mean, it's like, it's one of those dreams that feels like more than a dream. And because of that, it's just like, you can't forget it. You know, you wake up and it's just as real as if it were still happening. I'm assuming, I don't know. I can't speak from personal experience here.
I remember when I was a teenager, I had a dream that my parents bought a new minivan. It was just incredibly real.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up and I was getting breakfast and stuff. And I went outside and came back in the house and asked my mom if dad had taken the van. And she just looked at me like I was crazy. And because they didn't buy a new van. And yeah. She's like, what? And I was like, the new van. Did dad take the new van to work? And she's like, what are you talking about? And then all of a sudden I realized that I had dreamt this entire thing, but I went through hours of the day, the next day, believing that this thing had happened.
Yeah, well, this is a pretty vivid dream.
Yeah,
I mean, I certainly have woken up many times and been like, it'll take me a few seconds where I had like convinced myself that whatever I just dreamed about was not real. And it's usually something bad, you know.
Yeah.
So I wake up thinking that something bad has happened, or I've done something bad, or somebody else around me has, and I'm like, man, that was just a dream, right? And I got kind of convinced myself. And then I can like calm down. Yeah. Okay. All right. That wasn't reality. But in this case, it was reality. Back to the story of Gideon and his buddy. He's going to interpret this dream very accurately. That's precisely what's going to happen. So anyway, after Gideon and his servant Puah, after they overhear this dream, well, that's all he needs. He's got his confidence back. In fact, he not just like he's full of confidence. He actually bows down in worship, it says in verse 15. So he knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that God has given this particular dream and its interpretation. And so he receives that as he should in thanksgiving for that gift. So anyway, he goes back to the camp to his 300 guys, and he says, "Arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands." He's basically quoting the guy that interpreted the dream. So he's certain now, no more fear. But I don't know about his soldiers. I mean, if I was in this group of 300 guys with Gideon and I heard him lay out the battle plan, I'd probably need to hear a dream and an interpretation myself, because I would probably be pretty nervous at this point. All those we talked about last week, I think maybe these 300 guys are a little different. They're possibly kind of a strange crowd, because they don't seem to be at all hesitant to follow Gideon's battle plan. Because here's what it is. So he takes these 300 guys and he divides them up. So we got three companies. And he says he put trumpets and empty jars or empty pitchers into their hands. And then they have these torches inside the pitchers. So I guess these are like big jars of clay or something like that. And they could like put the torches up in them to shield some of the light, something like that. And then he says, "Okay, look at me and do what I do." He says, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to come to the outskirts of the camp, and then you just follow my example." It says, "When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you blow the trumpets all around the camp." So I'm assuming they're kind of spread out, 100 over here, 100 over there, 100 over there. So here's what when we do that, then we're going to blow the trumpets and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. So this is what they do. Verse 19 says that Gideon and his 100 guys, they go to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. So beginning of the middle watch is going to be midnight. Most of the time back then, I think the Romans divided the night differently, but most of the time divisions of the night are three different watches. First watch is 8 to 12. Second watch is 12 to 4. Third watch is 4 to 8. So this is beginning of the second watch. So this is the middle watch. So this is midnight. So everybody's pretty much out by then. And it says they blew the trumpets, and then they smashed the jars. And then the three companies blew the trumpets. And it says when all this happened, they held the torches in their left hands. They held the trumpets in their right hand. And I guess after they blew the trumpets, they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Which is actually quite humorous, because they don't have any swords.
Right.
Or if they did, they're like sheathed on their belt. It's not like they got a sword ready to attack. Well, anyway, that's the plan. And it worked. Verse 21 says that they all stood their place around the camp, and the enemy army, there's three verbs that are used to describe what they did. It says that they ran and they cried out, and they fled. Not only that now, that would be enough. I mean, they scared them so much as it take off. But not only that, it says when they blew the 300 trumpets, God goes to work. It says the Lord set the sword of one against another throughout the whole army. So they're so confused, they're so bewildered, they're so scared that, I just picture you have friendly fire going on. All these enemy soldiers are just like freaking out and stabbing each other, killing each other. And whoever survived, and there were a bunch of them that died, we'll get to that next chapter, but those who survived, they just take off. They go to, we have all these place names, they go to Beth Shittah and Zerathah, as far as the edge of Abel Meholah by Tabat. We know where absolutely none of those places are, but we do know they're heading east, because they're going toward the Jordan River. We'll finish out this. We only got like three verses left. So it says the men of Israel summoned. So I guess after this happens, they summoned some more soldiers. They summoned the people from the tribes of Naphtali and Asher and all of Manasseh. And they pursue Midian. And then Gideon, he sends messengers into the hill country of Ephraim. And he says, hey, come down against Midian and take the waters before them as far as Bet Barah in the Jordan. So the men of Israel, they grab their swords and they take off to the Jordan River. And they captured two of the leaders, two guys with pretty cool names. One is named Orev, which means raven, and one is named Ze'ev, which means wolf. So pretty good military names, wolf and raven, Orev and Ze'ev. They captured two of those guys, and they kill Ze'ev. They kill Wolf at the wine press, and they name that place after him. The wine press is Ze'ev. And then they kill the other guy at some rock, which is afterward named the Rock of Orev. And they chop their heads off, and they bring them back to Gideon across the Jordan River. I'd say it's a pretty successful military operation.
Three things. One, if I put myself in the position of Gideon's soldiers, this is very unsettling when the plan comes out. Because I definitely would be like, wait, we're going to do what? We're going to have torches and trumpets. And this is what we're going to do. So we're not going to go element of surprise, go in there and, set the place on fire. So we're going to literally in the middle of the night announce that here we are. And there's only 300 of us. This is the plan. So under cover of night, we're just going to eliminate that. And just tell everyone that we're around you. So if I'm on that side, I'm definitely a little concerned about this battle plan. However, if I put myself in the Midian situation, it does sound pretty freaky. Like if it's the middle of the night and trumpets blast, and then like all I hear all this pottery breaking or something, and then like this cry goes out, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. I think I would assume if I was a Midian soldier that there must be an insane amount of guys about to come down on me because that would make no sense to give yourself away like this. And it's just a chaotic thing. You're like, what is breaking? What's going on with the trumpets? I mean, can you imagine just hearing all these jars breaking everywhere and then like trumpets blasting? And I mean, that's a freaky thing to wake up to for sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I can see both sides.
Yeah, both sides. So if I'm the one doing it, I'm definitely concerned because I know about our numbers. If I'm the one on the receiving end, that sounds crazy because it's just way too confident. Anyone coming in that amount of confidence, you're like, oh, what do they have? Like a million guys up there? So yeah. So there's that. Third thing is, again, we see where when the Lord goes after the enemy, I mean, it is... Did we hear anything about Gideon losing anybody? We hear nothing. It is always just a complete rout.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, I mean, no losses that you know of. Just a complete and utter annihilation. And this is always the way this happens, right? Because when God is dealing with his enemies, he does all the work and you end up unscathed.
Yeah, I mean, I think we mentioned this at the close of the last podcast. I mean, this is so exemplary of, I mean, I don't know how many times God conducts warfare like this, right? He utterly demolishes the enemy, but he does so in, I mean, not just like unconventional sorts of ways, but just crazy, crazy sorts of ways. This I don't know if this is the craziest battle plan in the scriptures, but it ranks pretty close. I mean, these guys are like they're coming back from band class and going to pottery class or something. I mean, they got torches and they've got clay jars and they got trumpets. I mean, it's sort of, I guess you could compare it to what happened at Jericho, right?
Yeah.
I mean, same sort of thing, right? Except that was more drawn out, happened during the day, but it was the same thing. They shouted, they blew the trumpets and down came the wall. This is one of these battles that wasn't soon forgotten. This remained in the Israel of in the memory of Israel for up until now. I mean, it was so significant a battle that it kind of became like one of those historic events that you can refer to just by way of shorthand. You know, like we, if this is a, this is not the best example because it wasn't a victory for us, but it is a military example. Like if today somebody mentions Pearl Harbor, you don't really need to say anything else. Right. And in the minds of Americans, that's all you got to say. Those two words, Pearl Harbor, you don't have to give a year. You don't have to explain the situation. You don't have to say exactly where Pearl Harbor is located. You don't have to say the combatants who were involved. You don't have to say anything. Just those two words. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, of course, we know exactly what you're talking about. Now, the reason I say this is because that particular way of referring to what happened with Gideon and his men became kind of a stock phrase or a shorthand way of thinking about this whole situation. Now, the reason I'm saying all this is because I'm gonna take us to a section of Isaiah, where, as it turns out, Isaiah references what we discovered. So he references Gideon and the battle and the victory and all of that, but he does so only by way of shorthand, just kind of a throwaway phrase. But he expects his people, his readers, his listeners, to understand what he's talking about. And another reason this is significant is not just, oh, look, there was a prophet, Isaiah, and he knew about this battle and he makes reference to it. No, it's more important than that, because this is going to happen in Isaiah chapter 9. And if you know anything about Isaiah's messianic sections, this happens to be right in the heart of when he talks about the son of David. So if you look at Isaiah 9, I just want to look at these few verses as an example of how the prophets were interpreting the earlier stories of Israel in reference to the Messiah. I mean, we, of course, this podcast is all about talking about Christ in the Old Testament in a variety of different ways. Well, this is nothing new because the prophets themselves did this. So let me show you from Isaiah chapter 9, how this works. So the opening verse, you're probably all familiar with. You've heard this in church. It says, there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and treated the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Of course, that comes up in Matthew, right? I mean, early in the Gospel of Matthew, the evangelist quotes these words, and he quotes them specifically in reference to the ministry of Jesus around the area of Galilee. So Matthew is understanding Isaiah 9 in connection with the ministry of Jesus. All right? So that's the way the chapter starts out. But listen, it goes on. Isaiah says, "You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They shall be glad in your presence, as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil." Okay, so he's talking about how the nation's joy is going to increase. It's going to be gladness in the nation. In fact, it's going to be like the kind of gladness after a battle when the soldiers are victorious and they divide the spoil. That's the kind of joy and gladness that's going to be experienced in the nation. So he's already introducing here this image of warfare and dividing the spoil. But listen, very next verse, this is Isaiah 9, verse 4. He says, "For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian." So this battle of Midian that he refers to in Isaiah 9, verse 4, is the battle that we're talking about here in the book of Judges. And we know that because a couple chapters later, in chapter 10, he again refers to the battle of Midian, and he makes specific reference to the killing of Oreb and Zeeb. So we know this is the battle that Isaiah has in mind. Now, the reason I think this is wonderful is because Isaiah's talking about the Christ. He's talking about what he's going to do. He's talking about the impact that he's going to make upon the nation. He's talking about how there's going to be gladness and rejoicing. And then he introduces the military imagery about the dividing of spoil. And then he shifts immediately to talking about how the Messiah is going to break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders. Just think of what Midian and the Amalekites have been doing to Israel. And then he introduces the simile of the Messiah's work compared to what the work of Gideon was in defeating the Midianites. And then he goes on in verse 6 to quote, to give us these words that are quoted very often in Christmas time. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, the government will rest on his shoulders, his name will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, so on and so forth. So it's kind of it's a really cool section of Isaiah, because you can see how Isaiah is not only preaching about the work of the Messiah, but he's preaching that work with specific reference to the work that God did in days of old. So in other words, when Isaiah reads the book of Judges, he reads the book of Judges with a Christological hermeneutic. That is to say, he reads the book of Judges with an interpretive lens that is shaped by the person and the work of the Messiah. So he's reading the book of Judges like we read the book of Judges. He's looking for Christ, and he's preaching Christ on the basis of these actions of God in the days of the Judges. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, who knew that Judges 7 had Christmas implications?
Yeah, I know. It's kind of wild that but I mean, Isaiah would do that, and he beckons us to do the same thing. I mean, it really is. It's the same thing that we've stressed over and over, beginning with episode 1, and now where we're at now, 205 or something like that. I mean, when you're reading the Old Testament, if you're not looking for the message and the work of the Christ, then you're doing it wrong, because Christ himself said these scriptures testify of me. So in one way or the other, he's going to be there. And it just so happens that we have a great example of how the Old Testament itself testifies to him being there when Isaiah gives us this interpretation that he has of Judges chapter 7 too. Okay, so what's going to happen now? Well, we're going to jump into chapter 8 and find out what happens. So they've got two of the leaders, but a bunch of people got away. So what's going to happen with the rest of them? Well, before we find out, we're going to have a little bit of a squabble between a couple of the tribes. So verse 1 of chapter 8 starts out by saying that there were some Ephraimites, so from the tribe of Ephraim, who go to Gideon, and they're all upset. They're upset because evidently when Gideon was first planning the battle strategy and, you know, contacting various tribes, he left out the tribe of Ephraim, and they're all hurt about this. They say, you know, what is this you've done to us by not calling us out to fight when you went against Midian? You know, there must be something about the tribe of Ephraim, because this same thing is going to come up in chapter 12 of Judges, where they make the same complaint. You know, why did you leave us out? Why didn't you call us when you're wanting to go to battle? So I don't know if it's like some kind of inferiority complex they have, or if they're just like, man, we like to fight, and if you leave us out, we're going to be mad about it. I don't know what it is, but there's something about this tribe.
Yeah, it's also easy to be upset that you weren't called to fight after the victory.
Yeah, this is true.
He's like, oh, my bad. Did I not give you an invitation to come hold lance, hold torches and blow trumpets? Were you like all about that idea? Is that what it was? Very, very easy to be like, man, we would have been there after like a resounding victory.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me not to believe that they, I mean, there were 32,000 Israelites that showed up originally. I mean, you're trying to tell me that the Ephraimites weren't aware of this? You know, it seems to me like they're just they're complaining because they like to complain. Whatever it might be, that's their complaint. So how's Gideon gonna handle this? It says, well, he responds. He's actually very diplomatic. The Gideon that we meet right here is not the Gideon that we're gonna encounter later in this chapter, because Gideon, and we'll find out, I think, why as time goes on. But Gideon here is very diplomatic. He's very calm. In his answer, he says, you know, what have I done? in comparison with you. And he uses this kind of proverbial expression. He says, is not the gleanings of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Which, that doesn't make any sense to us. But what he's saying is, listen, I come from the little clan of Abiezer. And even our best grapes, even our vintage crop, is nothing compared just to the mere gleanings of the tribe of Ephraim. So he's trying to like butter him up, basically saying, listen, we're nothing compared to you guys. Don't get upset with us. You know, we're pipsqueaks. You guys are the best. So just calm down. And then he goes on, he says, God has given the leaders of Midian, Orebans, even to your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? So he's downplaying his own significance here, and he's upplaying their significance as a way to just try and calm them down and take care of their anger toward him. And it works. It says his answer took care of the problem. Their anger subsided toward him when he said this. So, if nothing else, we can learn from that, this particular exchange between these, is that there was a lot of tribal disunity at this time in Israel, the kind of disunity that we're going to see quite a bit until David. David is the first one to really kind of pulls all the tribes together, and he doesn't do that right away. It takes him several years. And then Solomon is the time period when Israel, in fact, unless you count the period of Moses, the time of Solomon is the only time period where Israel is actually pretty unified. But after he dies, it's all over. Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall, and there's no putting it back together again. You've got the division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom after the death of Solomon. So things fall apart rather quickly at that point. But even here, we see this kind of tribal disunity happening. Pick up with verse 4, and it says that Gideon's men is 300 men. He just still got 300.
Well, this is what leads me to believe he didn't lose anybody, because he still got 300 guys with him, and I assume these are the same don't-know-how-to-drink-water guys.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, presumably they just stood there holding torches, blowing trumpets, and watching us, the Midianites, just massacred each other. And not a single one were lost.
And now you got 300 guys pursuing some guys.
Yeah, yeah, right. So they're going to go after them, and we'll have to see the rest of their pursuit next week. But here's what happens first. So they've had a long journey. They're worn out. It says they were weary, but they were pursuing. They were chasing after these guys, and they stop at this place called Sukkot. So they're on the other side of the Jordan now. So on the west side, the east side, the Transjordan. And they come to this place that's called Sukkot, which is the word for like the Feast of Sukkot, maybe you've heard of, the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles. I don't know what's named that, but that's what the name means. So they come to this place. It's an Israelite town. And they basically ask for some provisions. They say, give us some bread. Give me and my men some bread, because we're tired, we're hungry, and we're chasing down these two kings. Kings named Zebah and Zalmunna. I mean, you would think that this was an Israelite town, and I'm guessing that the Midianites had been making life hard for them, just like they had for other people. But anyway, the leaders say, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? In other words, why should we give any bread to you? You don't have any proof that you're going to be able to pull this off. And Gideon responds, okay, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will thrash your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. So much for diplomacy. Gideon lost his diplomacy along the way. And so when he speaks to the leaders of Sukkot, he issues a threat. And as we'll see in the next episode, he follows through with that particular threat. But we're gonna have to leave kind of the threat hanging in the air at this time, because we are out of our 40 minutes.
We are. And that is like the definition, I think, of being hangry, right? Like, this dude is real hungry. You won't give him food. And he's like, dude, when I get back here, I am not going to forget how hungry I am right now.
I'm going to go to town on you. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's guys, good. That is 40 minutes. We will find out what a thrashing with thorns and briars looks like next week. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going over to 1517 and going to the donate page. You can make a monthly contributor over there. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Hey, stay tuned, because immediately following this, we will give you a little sample of Hidden Streams, the new devotional podcast with Chad Bird and others. Chad, we'll see you next week.
See you then.
Psalm 31 starts out by praying that God would let me never be put to shame. Shame is a feeling that's related to who we are, not necessarily what we've done. If guilt is a feeling of remorse over something that we've done, shame is a feeling of remorse over who we are. And so it gets to the very core of our being, gives expression to that feeling that we don't measure up, or that we fear we don't measure up in the eyes of other people. So by starting out Psalm 31 with these words, "In you, O Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed," or "let me never be put to shame," we're putting ourselves in the Lord's hands and acknowledging that He is the one who establishes our identity and our worth and our honor as those who are created in His image and likeness. And so rather than feeling shame over who we are, we find joy and comfort in knowing whose we are, that we are those created in the image and likeness of God and redeemed by Christ. And so those who will not be ashamed, because our refuge is in the Lord, who loves us and will continue to show mercy to us.